Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man who brings enormous intelligence to the issue of national security, as well as extraordinary experience over a lifetime, both in uniform, rising to the ranks from seaman to four-star Navy admiral, and now in a private capacity as the president of Lyons Associates, is our first guest, Admiral James Ace Lyons, one of the authors of a very important letter recently sent to the congressional leadership about the Iran deal, and we want to talk with Admiral Lyons about that and much more. Admiral, it's always a pleasure to have you on deck. Thank you so much for joining us.
Nice to be with you, Frank, and your listeners.
The pleasure is ours. Sir, you were instrumental to pulling together this letter with some of your comrades. I believe it's up to over 230 flag officers and general officers of the United States military, all now, of course, retired, including some 24, 25 four-stars like yourself. Could you characterize both the nature of this initiative and its importance if Congress is doing its job?
Frank, the basic fundamental issue here is we never should have sat down to negotiate with this evil regime, the world's leading state sponsor of terrorism that has killed thousands of Americans. And your listeners should never forget that it was Iran that provided the key material and training support to the 9/11 hijackers, and that 3,000 innocent Americans who were doing nothing more than going to work would be alive today. The fact that we sat down at the table with them to negotiate, to me, is unconscionable. It'd be like sitting down with Hitler in 1939. I cannot believe we did this.
And, Admiral, what we've done, arguably, is enable a regime that is at least as dangerous as that of Adolf Hitler's in terms of its global ambitions, its messianic designs, that with nuclear weapons poses a vastly more formidable threat. And what I'm struck by is, as I look at this distinguished group of admirals and general officers, that we're not hearing much from the United States military still in uniform on this deal. You continue to have relationships with those folks. You watch very closely what's going on in the Pentagon. Is that because they're indifferent to this, or that they have concluded that, in fact, despite your analysis and that of your colleagues, this is actually a good deal or a good idea? Or are they being sidelined, marginalized, and neutered?
Well, it goes back to political correctness, Frank. And I tried to get Senator McCain, the chairman of the Armed Services Committee, to actually call up all of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and make them testify and take a position on this treaty, which I believe is absolutely necessary that he do this. Make them commit one way or the other. They must live up to their oath of office, and this cannot be just brushed aside.
This didn't work out, obviously, but do we have reason to believe that the Joint Chiefs are, in fact, concerned about this, Admiral Lyons? I know that some of them have made noises to the effect that they think it's an appropriate thing to do under the circumstances, or comments to that effect, but there's not an overwhelming enthusiasm. That's fair to say, I think. But what I guess I'm really getting at is, has the United States military been as central to the construction of this agreement as they ultimately will have to deal with the consequences of it, as has been true in the past in various arms control agreements with which you and I have both been associated?
Well, let me say this, Frank. First of all, this emasculation of our military leadership just didn't start with this agreement. It has gone on for years under this administration. And quite frankly, it's a situation that we had prior to World War II. You have all these politically correct leaders who are put in positions of authority. And what happened at the start of World War II? You had to replace them all. And that's what has to be done today. They had an oath of office. They have not lived up to their oath of office to protect and defend this great country of ours, and they must be held accountable.
Admiral Lyons, again, one of the authors of this joint letter, some 230, as I recall, senior military leaders, now retired, offering their professional advice to the Congress of the United States and very much arguing against the approval of this nuclear deal. I call it the Obama bomb deal, Admiral, as you know. I wondered if I could just quickly run by you some comments that former Vice President Dick Cheney has made in the past day or two. He's got a new book out entitled Exceptional, Why the World Needs a Powerful America. And he basically describes this Iran agreement as a, quote, train wreck, unquote. He also suggests that the president never was willing to consider the use of force. The Iranians understood that. And as he put it, they knew, quote, if they played hard to get, he'd give them the store. And he did, unquote. Is that your view as well?
Oh, absolutely. I'm glad you mentioned the book. I just purchased it and I'm just starting to get into it. But Dick Cheney is actually right on the mark. What we've done here is unconscionable. All our objectives that we set out, we conceded to Iran. This deal was a total sellout. And of course, for Secretary Kerry, this is about the first time he has sold out his country. But in this particular case, we're agreeing to not only assist Iran in the development of their nuclear program, but we committed ourselves to show them how to protect their facilities against attack, sabotage, and cyber warfare. This is unbelievable. We totally switched sides, and we totally undercut our staunchest ally in the Middle East, Israel. Israel must go on a war footing. There's no question about it. They may have to use some of the most sophisticated weapons they have to ensure their survivability.
We're going to be talking with Colonel John Warden, who is the architect of the Desert Storm air campaign, about just how hard that will be, Admiral. But what you're saying sounds, at least implicitly, as though that may mean the use actually of nuclear weapons as well. Is that something you're contemplating?
Absolutely. If they want to survive, they've got to consider the use of nuclear weapons, or as a minimum, an EMP attack against Iran.
Admiral, let me turn just to one other topic, if I may, because, again, you've had long experience in the region, among other things, as the commander of the U.S. Pacific Fleet, involved in protecting flows of oil and our other assets and interests in that region over many, many years. What do you make of what the Obama administration is doing? We've recently marked, in a fashion, the first anniversary of the so-called war against the Islamic State. How would you characterize the conduct of that war, if you would call it that, and where we stand a year on?
Well, it's not a serious effort, number one. 80% of our air missions do not deliver their weapons. They return to base with their weapons intact because of the restricted rules of engagement that imposed. We are not going after ISIS in their core areas, which is Syria. And the reason we're not doing that, because that might upset our Iranian interlockers here. In fact, it's a travesty that we're subjecting the people of the region to the atrocities committed by the 7th century mentality of the ISIS group.
And in a way, really, that's what I wanted to close with, Admiral. We're talking about an environment in which we are failing to understand that what we're up against is that global jihadist 7th century mentality. And by failing to do so, we're simply intensifying the danger it represents. Admiral Lyons, you are a voice a clear and much valued voice of reason and, I believe, insight into the military as well as strategic and national security implications of all this. We appreciate your service as the chairman of the Center for Security Policy's Military Committee. I look forward to talking with you again very soon. Next up, we'll be talking about the air campaign, both against the Iranians, if should there be one, and against the Islamic State with Colonel John Morton right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
If you listen to this radio station a lot, you may have noticed our brand new name. It's got a catchy ring to it. But there's more than that. The name actually tells you who we are and what we do in one word. It took us a while to come up with this, but we realized if there's one thing we want to be to DC listeners, it was this. We want to be your answer to everything, to what happened while you slept, to why am I stuck in traffic, to how do you get control of this country again. Big stuff and little stuff. This may be a tall order for one radio station, but we know we're up for it. AM 1260, The Answer.
Great news for fans of Secure Freedom Radio. Now you can watch original Frank Gaffney and Center for Security Policy video content every day from the comfort of your living room. What makes this possible? A new video streaming service called Roku. All you need is a Roku player and a television to join the millions of Americans who customize their home viewing experience using the more than 1,000 Roku channels to access movies, TV shows, music, and more. When you add the cost-free Secure Freedom Roku channel, you'll gain unlimited streaming access to vital video products of the center, including Secure Freedom Radio, Capitol Hill and National Press Club events, intelligence briefings, Frank Gaffney's acclaimed 10-part Muslim Brotherhood in America course, and more. The Secure Freedom Roku channel integrates information and entertainment, establishing a new media battle space in the war for the free world. Go to securefreedom.org/ROKU today to learn how you can be a part of it. We hope you'll see us soon.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. Colonel John Warden is our guest, I believe for the first time here at Secure Freedom Radio. He is, among other things, a man who was an architect of the Desert Storm Air Campaign, a retired now colonel in the United States Air Force with a distinguished career in uniform, but now contributing mightily to the public understanding of the challenges we're facing, militarily and otherwise, as the founder and president of Venturist. He is the author of two best-selling books, The Air Campaign and Winning in Fast Time. Colonel, welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. Great to have you with us, sir.
Frank, thank you very much. Thank you.
I've been reading some of your public ruminations about an issue that is on my mind, and I think should be on a lot of others as well. We're being told as this debate unfolds about the, I call it the Obama bomb deal in the United States Congress, that some of those who are now rogering up to approve this thing seem to be saying that, well, if it doesn't work out, we'll just have to use military force against them, and somehow we'll be better equipped to do so. We'll be, as the administration, I think, is saying, we'll know more about the target set and the like. As a man who's actually organized and helped mount air campaigns, how do you view the hardness of the Iranian target as it stands now, let alone what might happen after this deal?
The whole idea of attacking Iran is one that would need some really, really careful thought, because it has a lot of repercussions. Number one, I'm convinced that it is no longer possible. Perhaps 10 years ago, it would have been possible to have hit selective nuclear targets within Iran and perhaps have taken them out. Today, I believe it's impossible, and as you move forward, becomes even more difficult, simply because the Iranians are very good engineers, they're very smart, and that they have done an excellent job of dispersing all of their targets, putting them deep underground, and so on.
Colonel John Warden is our guest, the author of The Air Campaign, something he knows a lot about because he organized one in Desert Storm, a very important component of that successful military operation. He is today the founder and president of Venturist, and we're visiting with him about the challenge that we would face were we to have to go to war with Iran, and whether we're likely to make it even more problematic by endorsing this deal. And Colonel Warden, you were just describing what might have been 10 years ago is probably foreclosed today. What does it look like if either of two things eventuate, namely one, the Russians do sell, at last, the S-300 air defense system, and secondly, possibly the Russians and maybe the Chinese as well, advanced, maybe even an armada of advanced fighter aircraft.
Tactically, that would certainly make the job significantly more difficult. But I think what everybody needs to recognize is that if you were serious about shutting down the an Iranian nuclear program, probably the only feasible way to do it is to shut down Iran itself. And that's a pretty dramatic kind of a thing to do. It would have enormous repercussions in all kinds of different places. But that actually could be done. Very, very expensive in terms of lives lost and repercussions, but that could be done. And I suspect that within the next period of time, 5-10 years, sort of regardless of what the Russians or the Chinese might do with arming Iran, that kind of an action would still be a feasible thing to do. But for us to do that, to shut down, I mean literally to shut down the functioning of a country that has so many millions of people in it, it would be an extraordinary thing for us to do. And I suspect it would be extraordinarily difficult to get any kind of support from any place else in the world for us doing something like that.
Colonel, of course, against this backdrop that you've just painted, which is very dire indeed, there's another component, and that is, even as the Iranians seem to be making their target set more resilient and beefing up their capabilities to defend it, our own air power projection capabilities seem to be dramatically declining, certainly relative to what you dealt with in 1991. Give us a flavor as a retired Air Force command pilot and colonel as to the condition of, the air services more generally, not just the Air Force.
So the total numbers that are available are certainly less. The general capability is pretty good, and in some cases it's actually has expanded somewhat, and the expansion has come through significantly through things like the programs to allow the B-2 bombers to carry a lot more individually targeted weapons. AB-2 can do extraordinary things and is probably still able to penetrate.
Even with the F-300?
I don't know. I'm sure somebody knows, but the knowledge, as you will well know, would be at a level of classification that might even exceed the Hillary email classification scheme. So
not possible.
Well, I don't know. Maybe not. But I think what really concerns me is not so much today, but it is 5 years, 10 years from now. And the reason why I'm so concerned about that is because that with the kinds of wars that we've been fighting over the last 10 years, we really kind of stopped growing and stopped our significant technology development. And focused so much of our efforts on doing the kinds of things that apply to improvised explosive devices in Iraq and Afghanistan. So it would be a little bit of a stretch to say that we have lost 10 years, but it's pretty darn close to that.
Colonel, let me turn quickly to one other threat you've been focusing on, I know, intensively, as you should. And that is this Islamic State. We've seen an air campaign of a fashion waged against it. How would you characterize that campaign and, I guess, as well, its adequacy to the present task?
The Islamic State is a very, very tough and a very, very dangerous enemy. I'm convinced that it can be taken down militarily with primarily air operations, but it can't be taken down with what is going on now, which is really a very serial attack. So you do a little bit, you attack a few things, sometimes with some degree of success, but then there is so much opportunity for the Islamic State to regroup, to put itself back together. If we're going to be successful, we really simply need to increase the intensity, probably by a factor of 10, and we also need to stop saying nonsensical things like it's going to take generations to defeat the Islamic State. The right answer is we ought to be able to do it and can do it within a matter of months, if not actually weeks.
And Colonel, I guess that sort of brings us to the last very quick point. As a military man who has gone to war with people of this mindset, I guess it's fair to say, What is your judgment as to how they're taking what has been described as kind of our pinprick approach, as opposed to an all-out assault that is seriously designed to take them down?
I wish we had more time to discuss this, but my simple answer is that I believe that a significant number of people, perhaps especially associated with the Democratic Party, learned nothing from Vietnam other than what in their view was, oh, that was a bad war for whatever geopolitical reasons. But they didn't understand at all that the way that we went about fighting that war was disastrous in itself. So the idea of escalation and gradualism and so on, in their mind, seems to be a valid approach. And it was extraordinarily expensive and disastrous 40 years ago. And there's no reason to think that it would have any better effect today.
I would argue that it's calculated to fail even worse when you're dealing with people who believe it's God's will that they will prevail over you. So, Colonel John Warden, this is a most important conversation. I hope you'll allow us to continue it in the near future. Thank you for the work that you have been doing for our country, both in uniform and adventurist, and also for your terrific books, The Air Campaign and Winning in Fast Time. Keep it up. Come back to us again soon. Russ Reed joins us next from the Endowment for Middle East Truth on the Iranian missile threat. That and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Daniel Horowitz is a singularly thoughtful and articulate critic of those in power, without regard for their party or position, who are making our time more perilous. In a column yesterday at conservativereview.com, Mr. Horowitz warns of the predictably negative effects on law and order arising from what he calls the war on police being waged by Team Obama and its partisans. Unfortunately, he notes, they are being aided and abetted by some on the right who are pursuing what is euphemistically marketed as prison reform. Daniel Horowitz persuasively argues that the present juncture when law enforcement is under assault by both emboldened criminal elements and the Obama Justice Department is no time for conservatives to join the left in eliminating minimum sentences and releasing felons from jail. Like amnesty for illegal aliens, that's a formula for disaster. This is Frank Gaffney. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, joined, I believe, for the first time by another terrific guest, Russell Reed. He is a man who has been very active in the debate about Iran in his role as the deputy director for the legislative affairs portfolio at an absolutely indispensable organization here in Washington, D.C., the Endowment for Middle East Truth, better known as EMET. He is also, in his free time, the president and editor-in-chief of a very important web resource, ParabellumReport.com, an international security analysis website. It's a delight to have him with us. Russ, thanks so much for taking the time.
Thank you, Frank.
You've been writing recently about a piece of the Iranian debate that I don't think is getting nearly enough attention. I'm therefore very pleased to have you with us to discuss the ballistic missile program, and I guess missiles more generally that the Iranians have today and those that they seem intent on acquiring. Give us sort of a situational report on how things look at the moment and where you think they're likely to take things, especially if, as I understand it, under this deal, they may be able to get access to, well, ballistic missile technology resources from the international community far sooner than 8 years from now.
Yeah, absolutely. The Iranian missile threat is something that in this talk of centrifuges, uranium enrichment, plutonium reprocessing, sometimes gets kind of drawn to the side. That being said, we were told many, many months ago when I was first researching this issue that because the current JCPOA would not include things like missiles, terrorism, and other aspects of the Iranian threat, that, you know, this would not be as big of an issue. Of course, now that the final text of the deal is out, we have found out that in about 8 years after the deal goes through, that Iran will be able to purchase ballistic missiles from the international community. That's a pretty scary thing, undoubtedly, given the Iranian threat and what they've been doing in the region otherwise. But what I think a lot of people don't realize is Iran already has the largest and most diverse stockpile of ballistic missiles in the Middle East. That includes Israel. Israel's got much better, higher tech missiles, but Iran, as far as their capability, is extensive and incredibly diverse.
And as Stalin said, quantity has a quality all its own. So it may not be that individually they're as high tech, but the numbers are a real problem.
Oh, they're incredible. And now we've seen the evidence of this with Hezbollah claiming they have the largest stockpile they've ever had, probably around 100,000 is from what I've heard from experts in that field. And so now, of course, you know, the reason Iran has got such a large, diverse ballistic missile arsenal is because back in the 80s when they were fighting the Iraqis, their air force was predominantly made up of F-14s and another American fighter craft that they were obviously not able to repair and keep up in the air. So when they lost that, they decided they'd go on this defensive style asymmetric threat with the missile arsenal. So the real concern that we have here vis-a-vis the deal is the fact that Iran has, as we already know, the largest stockpile, but also they're the only country ever to field an intermediate range ballistic missile, which is just under an intercontinental ballistic missile. They've right now got the capability of hitting as far out as Bucharest or Kiev. We know that. Now, the DOD said a few years ago that they should have an ICBM by 2015. In my article, I've estimated between 2015 and 2025 based on some of the intelligence estimates that are open source.
But surely, Russ, if the Iranians are able to get access to international technology, I mean, I think they've been getting it from at least the North Koreans for some time, and presumably Russia and China on the QT as well. But if basically there's no further impediment to them importing whatever technology they need, surely it's not going to take them 10 more years to move from what they've got in the way of an intermediate range ballistic missile to one capable of reaching, say, the United States.
I would guess not. I mean, if they continue on the trajectory they're at with this embargo completely lifted, it would not surprise me. But the real concern here is that they don't even need an ICBM to do some real damage. An IRBM is a tailor-made vehicle for a nuclear weapon. I think it's very telling as to what their intentions are that they still have an IRBM. They're the first country to ever use one in the field without mounting a nuclear warhead on it. So this is a huge concern. And in addition to that, range is crucial, but also technology and guidance systems are important here. The Iranians have archaic guidance systems, which is why they utilize things en masse. That's why their proxies use things en masse, Hezbollah, Hamas, etc. If they get access to the weapons technology that can make these things even more accurate, now we're talking about a threat matrix that quadruples maybe even more in its seriousness. So it's a big issue.
Russ, let me ask you about one other piece of this. We're very concerned about what the Iranians could be capable of doing right now to deliver a missile to the United States with devastating effect. It's been described as a so-called Scud in a tub scenario. They evidently have, as you say, vast numbers of relatively short-range missiles. They, as I understand it, have tested some of them from seagoing platforms, barges in the Caspian Sea, in a manner that looks as though electromagnetic pulse is something they have in mind. What do you know about that, and how serious a threat do you regard that to be, especially if you see these enhancements, notably the nuclear enhancements to the Iranian program coming forward?
Sure. Now, that actually, I think, is a very interesting topic that is not getting talked about enough. Now, the guy who I defer to on this generally is Ambassador James Woolsey, former CIA Director Leonard Clinton, who I believe you've had on the show before. Now, he's been talking about this for the better part of a decade. The EMP threat from Iran is incredible because, as we both know, and as I'm sure the audience is aware, Iran prefers to utilize asymmetric tactics. They're not going to try to fight the West one-on-one or any of the other enemies within the region. They prefer to go asymmetric. They prefer to do things that are outside the box, very creative. Now, the Scud in a tub scenario is one that I believe Ambassador Woolsey and Peter Pry both worked very hard on. And I actually cite them in my article. Now, that would be a situation where, let's say off the coast of the Atlantic Ocean, there's a trawler of some kind, and they take a rudimentary missile, not anything very fancy or advanced, and they would launch it into the atmosphere, detonating it above the United States or another target, thus creating not a nuclear explosion, but an electromagnetic pulse, EMP, that would fry the electronic grid and microchips and various other electronic devices that we utilize in our everyday lives. So it's an asymmetric threat that wouldn't really kill anybody immediately, But what they're trying to do there is essentially create havoc, which I've heard estimates, ranging from 66 to 90% of the population with a successful EMP could be under threat. So it's a devastating scenario.
Staggeringly dangerous, indeed. And the thing that I just to clarify, there would, of course, be a nuclear detonation. It's just that it would be out in outer space, not over the population centers of the United States. But the effect would be even more cataclysmic, as you say. Russ Reed is our guest. He is with the Endowment for Middle East Truth. You might just take a minute, if you would, and we only have about a minute, to talk about one other piece, Russ, of the Iranian threat that, again, I think is not getting nearly enough attention, and that is the threat to global shipping, particularly that in one of the most critical waterways in the world, the Persian Gulf.
Yes, absolutely. Now, that's the second threat that I outlined in the piece that I wrote for Real Clear Defense, and it's crucial because the Iranians are engaging in a Chinese tactic that's being referred to, as I mentioned in my piece, area denial and anti-access. That basically is investing in things like anti-ship missiles and cyber capabilities that deny your adversary from utilizing the regional space that they need. Now, the United States is a purely expeditionary force, and we need secure staging areas to be successful in our operations.
To say nothing of all the access to the oil that our allies depend upon so critically coming through that region.
Absolutely.
And how serious, just very quickly, Russ, how seriously do you think the Iranians threaten shipping through the Strait of Hormuz, for example, or elsewhere in the Gulf at this point, let alone what's coming if they get access to advanced conventional weapons?
I estimate in my article that 22% of the world's oil supply right now is under threat by the Iranians because they do have their proxies in Yemen near the Bab el-Mandeb and the Gulf's access with their coastline. So that's a massive threat, and it's one that I think we need to take very seriously.
Indeed, we do. You're taking it very seriously, as are your colleagues, the marvelous Sarah Stern at the Endowment for Middle East Truth. Check out the Emmett website, emmettonline.org. Thank you for the work you're doing there and also for the resource that you provide with ParabellumReport.com. Come back to us again very soon, if you would, Russ. Thank you very much for your work today. Hank Cooper, Ambassador Henry Cooper, joins us. We'll talk about a new letter from arms control and nuclear experts weighing in on the dangers of this Iranian deal. That and more straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
I lost my healthy 27-year-old son to influenza. Jacob wasn't someone you'd expect to die from the flu. He was strong, a martial arts athlete. After 5 weeks of fighting, Jacob died.
I'm Dr. Bill Schaffner of the National Foundation for Infectious Diseases. Each year, influenza claims the lives of Americans of all ages, including healthy young adults like Jacob. Ask about vaccination the next time you're at your doctor's office or pharmacy. Visit adultvaccination.org.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. I'm very pleased to say we're joined by an old colleague and friend of mine of many years now, Ambassador Henry Cooper, a man who, with great skill and savoir-faire, has navigated the highest levels of the United States government in several different incarnations. He was a Air Force officer, but went on to become an Air Force civilian. He was in the Arms Control and Disarmament Agency as an assistant director. He was an ambassador for President Reagan on the defense and space talks. And he served President George Herbert Walker Bush as the director of his Strategic Defense Initiative Organization. He has been one of the leaders behind a new letter in the effort to help illuminate the dangers with the Iran deal. This letter, I think, distinguished, among other things, by virtue of it being sent to the President of the United States. Ambassador Cooper, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. Congratulations on this new letter. I'm very pleased to be one of the signatories of it. Talk a little bit about who's on it and what its purpose is.
Well, Frank, I'm very pleased you joined us as well. We have 56 folks who've joined us, the vast majority of whom have had firsthand, hands-on experience in negotiations of one form and another, including two former chairmen of the standing consultative commission under the ABM treaty. Folks like myself who have led delegations with the Soviet Union, the CFE, and various other negotiations, and well understand what we're talking about as the problems of verification and so on. I forget how many now. There's at least eight, I think, former ambassadors who have signed on with arms control experience, as well as key people out of the intelligence community who have hands-on experience, again, in monitoring the treaties and that have been signed and the concerns that we've dealt with in the negotiations themselves. So what we have tried to do is to focus on getting really not just a letter, I don't want to say superficial, but just hitting high points of what the problems are with the deal, but also really strong measures that can be studied by the staff of senators and congressmen on Capitol Hill to understand what the true merits of this deal is, might be. And that's important because so much of the information on the deal has not been made public, has not even been made public to the president. I mean, we have deals that have been negotiated between Iran and the IAEA of the United Nations that even his negotiators have not seen and have not been party to. And maybe they've seen them now. So, and this deal itself is less constraining and removes the constraints, in fact, of the non-proliferation treaty to which Iran is already a signatory and which it has been violating for years in pursuing the building of the infrastructure to build nuclear weapons. And this deal doesn't even remove that.
You've spent a lifetime, Hank, in one form or another, as have many of the signatories of this new letter to the president, working on nuclear deterrence and nuclear capabilities and constraining those of our adversaries and dealing with their ability to threaten us with them or attack us with them. And that's one of the questions that I really wanted to make sure we discussed is, what in your professional judgment and that of your colleagues do you believe is the likelihood that this deal will not only prove to be a disaster in terms of actually constraining Iran's nuclear program, but will mark kind of the end of the effort to restrict the proliferation of these deadly weapons more broadly?
I think that's absolutely true. I mean, some of the Arab, Sunni Arabs in the region will not sit quietly by if Iran is absolutely free to build nuclear weapons. Some of us believe they may already have them and are going through a bit of a rain dance while they, get everything in order for major capabilities and spring that on everyone. But we can't imagine that Saudi Arabia and other countries there will just sit idly by while their Shia adversaries in the region gain this capability in the open, which is, I think, what this deal opens up. I think, it won't be a secret very long as to what they actually have if, in fact, they are near or have that capability now. They already have the means of delivering the weapons, certainly on Israel, but I believe also on the United States by way of putting them on satellites, for example, that they fire to the south and which escape the normal CARDA that we have designed our ballistic missile defenses against. So, and not to mention off of vessels off our coast or in the Gulf of Mexico where we have no defense.
And Ambassador Cooper, I just want to, again, commend you for what was done with this letter, not only in the body of it, but also this attachment. Talk just briefly about the importance of this 14-page document with some 40 footnotes sent to the president today by this array of 56 eminent figures, many of them quite prominent in this sort of counter-proliferation more broadly national security space.
Well, let me just say a word about the atmosphere into which we're going. Senators Casey and Coops, I believe is the way he says his name, just announced that they were going to be voting for the deal. That brings the number to 33. which is only one shy of having the ability to overturn, to sustain the president's veto power. So I think that, this is really crunch time. And Senator Reid is trying to get 41 votes that would even block debate on putting a measure before the president that he might veto. So it's crunch time. I think that the staffs up on Capitol Hill need to understand these issues, which is why we went into such detail in the documentations that you mentioned. And hopefully when Congress comes back, the staff will bore into this, if not before then, because I believe we have to head off at least the 41 vote, and I would hope even change minds for the 34 senators that would come up on the net and go along with this deal, which is a disaster. So, that's what it's all about. It's unlike other papers, which are just opinion papers. We try to document, still in a readable form, as you say, 14 pages, I think, counting the footnotes. So it's not too long for staff to read. And even if senators and representatives really care about these issues, for them to read and see the rationale behind why so many of us were willing to sign on. And I might add, there were others who would sign on, too, except for circumstances that they felt made it too risky for whatever the reasons to join us. There are many more out there who believe, as we do, that we're courting a major disaster, not only in our relationships and Israel's relationships with Iran, but in the stability of that entire region. I believe we're courting a nuclear arms race in the Middle East, and that is just a disaster waiting to happen. The NPT won't have any meaning after this, in my judgment. We'd be far better off if we reject this deal, we strengthen the sanctions that exist, and enforce the regime, the NPT regime, which already exists, in writing this new agreement, which won't be worth the paper it's printed on.
Henry Cooper, thank you very much for the great work. I didn't mention High Frontier, another inestimably important organization with which you are associated. Thank you for your past service to our country, as well as that you are rendering today with this important letter. You'll be able to find it, folks, at irantruth.org, among other places. Please check it out and make sure that your legislators are aware of it as well. Hank Cooper, thank you very much. We'll let you go. We'll talk with you again, I hope, very soon. Next up, Diana West joins us. We'll talk with her about immigration and more straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
People from around the country have no clue what we're like here in Washington, D.C. Yeah, we've got our whack jobs like the guy who climbed the fence and walked around the White House. We have the people who see the black helicopters. But there's one common denominator for all of us, friends and family. And there's no place where a relationship means more than it does right here. Yeah, we may be famous for the dignitaries, but friends and family, that makes us tick. And frankly, this radio station gets that. That's why I listen. AM 1260, The Answer.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. Diana West, my favorite, cultural monitor, shall we say. A woman who has been incredibly astute over the years in thinking about, writing about, helping the rest of us understand what is going on inside of our culture. She is, of course, the author of a terrific book on the subject, Death of the Grown-Up, and also another absolutely must-read about what I think of as the War for the Free World, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. She is, of course, also a syndicated columnist for many years and now a blogger par excellence at dianawest.net. Diana, we're glad to have you back as always. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
You have been writing about an issue that periodically flares up. I think it's fair to say that Donald Trump has caused it to flare rather dramatically of late. But so have events in Europe, namely immigration, mass movements of people, many of them Muslim, in what it would appear is best described as the practice of the Hijra, the colonization of non-Muslim lands by Muslims, in this case, largely impelled by various forces that are dislocating people from their native lands. But talk a little bit, Diana, about the culture, if you will, of Western civilization in Europe that is now truly under assault from these immigrants.
It is such a big subject that yes, my two books are really about this very subject. And, oh, I wish they were not so topical, because this really is American betrayal and the death of the grown-up, if you will, in action. We are watching the natural manifestation of completely neutralized and de-heartified, if that's a word, cultures that have been communized, cultures that have been Marxified. This is where we see the complete abandonment of identity, of sense of culture, of sense of nationhood, and worse, the transformation of those feelings for country, for culture, as becoming terrible negatives, moral obscenities, things to cast out, things to punish oneself for even having these feelings. And the net result of that, we are now watching play out very dramatically with this hijra. I think that's a very, very apt term. That is a term of Islamic colonization. These are largely Islamic crowds, hordes moving through, and they are largely men, at least the pictures I've been looking at out of Budapest. These are young military-age men. I can't help notice that, but they persist in describing them as migrant men and women, and I'm not seeing that many women, except for the terribly sad pictures and you know, tragic pictures of children and so on caught in wire and things like that. But when you actually look at the bulk, you are looking at a real invasion of thousands of men coming out of the Islamic world into Europe. Europe no longer has the sense of itself to simply man its border and say, no, it is absolutely cutting itself open.
You know, I've heard this statistic, and it seems absolutely unimaginable, but they're reporting that Germany will take 800,000 of these folks. And, you know, I was struck by a report that Little Iceland doesn't seem to have any of these refugees. And there are some well-meaning souls who are now mobilizing to try to see if they can't bring some of them to Iceland. What do you think the folks in Germany might have to say? They're not, obviously, as you indicated, Diana West, profiled very much. It's all about the sorry stories of the migrants. But what would you say that the people who live in these societies would advise if they had the chance to a country that hasn't been afflicted with this so far?
Well, real people, as opposed to most media and political elites who don't have to live in these conditions, real people who live in the towns and cities that have been colonized by the Hijra, and these are towns and cities across the continent, would tell Iceland that they are inviting in the colonization, the Islamic colonization of Iceland, something that Iceland has not experienced, has not had contact with really since the days of the slavers, the Islamic slavers that did go as far as north as Iceland and take the white slavers take Icelandic peoples into the Islamic slave network. This was something that plagued all of Europe, which is something, again, that we are not taught. The reason that we're seeing these kinds of patterns take place across Europe, I think, does go back to an earlier totalitarian ideology's success, and that would be the Marxification, the de-Christianization of Europe that was accomplished particularly in the post-World War II decades by the communization of Europe, by the infiltration of Marxism across Europe, even in outside the Soviet bloc, and to the United States, that now has completely secularized to a point of non-entification all of these cultures, all of these, yes, indigenous peoples that soon are going to be pockets and enclaves. We've seen this take place in England. England is a basket case and a case study. What happens when your country is overrun by peoples from cultures that are not compatible, that are indeed hostile and aggressively so toward the host culture.
Diana, you've written very powerfully about this recently at dianawest.net in an article entitled "What is PC?" And you might just elaborate on that briefly, if you would, because I think it seems so integral to this problem that you're talking about and put it in the context of what we ourselves are doing. This isn't just an issue for the Europeans. There's much of this afoot as well, this political correct secularization, de-Americanization as well, isn't there?
Well, this is actually an excerpt from American Betrayal, which, again, the betrayal is the betrayal of our elites, the betrayal of the American people, and it is about, the whole book is about this Marxification of our culture, our religion, our identity. And the mechanism, the most dangerous mechanism, and the one that we still can recognize, because I think much of this is so innate at this point, it's very hard to recognize, but I think we can still recognize the conditioning that goes on, the Orwellian conditioning. Now, he phrased it as 2 + 2 = 5, being the paradigmatic appraisal of how this is done. You repeat and you repeat something that's not true.
This is George Orwell you're talking about.
George Orwell, yes, and he was very onto this. Of course, back in 1949, when 1984 came out.
As a former socialist, as I recall, isn't that right?
As a former socialist, yes. And what he was describing was something that we all mostly have read it as appraising the totalitarian world. But he was actually also discussing and projecting into the so-called free world, where we have seen this same mechanism take place.
Let me just ask you quickly, we're almost out of time, Diana. You have written about Congressman Brian Babin introducing legislation that would actually try to have a breaking effect on some of this, at least the refugee resettlement piece of it. Give us a flavor of that and how important you think that initiative is.
Well, it's very important because, again, this is one of those moments where Congress seems to discover, oh my gosh, I do have control, or we do have control of the purse strings. The American government, meaning the American taxpayer, meaning you and me and everyone listening and beyond, are actually funding the resettlement of these alien groups, plopping down hundreds, sometimes thousands of people from Islamic countries or very primitive countries in our midst and expecting localities to cope with them, to deal with them, to support them is what happens. They are importing jihad and poverty and problems, and we are paying for it. So this particular amendment is extremely important. It seems like such an obvious measure to take, but it's very important to support the Babin project to try to at least cut the funding off on this aspect of our population replacement. That's what's going on. We can see it writ large in Europe. We can see it where we look in the United States.
Diana West, we have to leave it at that, I'm afraid. Thank you so much for all of your insights, the great work you do at dianawest.net, and of course our weekly visits. We look forward to them again. We look forward to talking to the rest of you again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.